Okay, good evening everyone, and welcome along to our study class this evening, where our brother Michael Edgecombe is going to begin presenting his series on the Gospel of the Son of God, which is 3 nights on the Gospel of Mark. So that should be good, and we're pleased to have his lovely wife, Sister Verity, here with us, and his almost as lovely son, Micah. Tonight the theme is the Gospel according to Peter. So we're going to introduce tonight by reading 2 Peter chapter 1, beginning of verse 10 through to the end of the chapter. So we'll hand over to Michael to talk to us about the Gospel of the Son of God.
Thanks very much, Sam. Good evening, everyone. As Sam has said, tonight we begin a three-part series here on the Gospel according to Mark. And we've chosen the title, The Gospel of the Son of God, because that is the key point that Mark seeks to make across his 16 chapters. And we'll have a look at that briefly tonight. It's like the key theme or the structuring principle or the one thing you should take away. If you forget everything else about the Gospel of Mark, remember that he sets forward Jesus as the Son of God. And in doing that, he shows us Jesus who is frankly human. He sleeps, he gets angry, he gets tired and frustrated like ordinary human beings because he is human. But he also presents to us a Jesus who is mind-blowingly divine. And that's something I invite you to look for as we read through the Gospel as well. Now, we've called tonight's study the Gospel according to Peter. And I want to spend tonight really showing, well, who was Mark, for example? What's his personal story? And how did he come to interact with Peter? And what's Peter got to do with the Gospel of Mark? And it's a fascinating and a powerful story. And I hope it gives you some new tools, if you like, or a new lens with which to see the Gospel according to Mark. I'm well aware that I stand in the shadow of true greatness here because I believe that James has completed a 20-year or... How long, James? An epic series.
Yeah, it felt a bit like that at times.
Yeah, okay. 100 years. Yeah, well, that felt like that for his wife. So an epic series on the Gospel according to Mark. And I'm sure that there'll be a common core and you'll see many echoes in what we have to talk about. Or really, we're only just going to get started on the Gospel according to Mark, but there'll be echoes, I'm sure, of what you learned as you worked through it with James, and then there might also be some new insights as well, which I hope will more enrich than confuse you. So we started by reading from the second letter of Peter, and you'll notice that in from verse 16, Peter focuses on the experience of the transfiguration. Right? You remember that extraordinary time where Peter, James, and John went up the mountain with Jesus, and they fell asleep, but he was praying, and as he was praying, he was transfigured. And Mark and the other gospel writers record that he just looked unearthly, like he was glowing white, like nothing on earth, says Mark. And then a cloud of glory enveloped them. Moses and Elijah were standing there. That really freaked them out. And they struggled to make sense of that experience, but it left an indelible imprint on their imagination. And years later, as Peter prepares to die, you'll notice that he talked in verse 13 about his tabernacle, or in my translation, perhaps yours also, it talks about his body. It does literally mean tabernacle. It's the metaphor of life as a transitory thing. You know, we pitch our tent, we live, the tent pegs are pulled up, the tent's folded away, the caravan moves on, and nothing is left behind to show that once upon a time somebody lived there. That's mortality. And Peter knows that his time to die is coming soon, and he's going to move on, and his tabernacle or his body will perish. He says it again in verse 14, the putting off of my tabernacle or body. So he knows that death is near, and he wants to leave a legacy for the believers who he knows will struggle as the apostles drop off one by one, and Peter himself, the great leader, is about to go. And so he says in verse 15, have a look at verse 15. He says, I'm reading from the ESV here, so apologies if that differs significantly from what you've got in front of you, but I hope you'll be able to translate. I will make every effort so that after my departure, you may be able at any time to recall these things. The word for departure there is the Greek exodos, which is the same word used of Jesus' departure or death in the Gospel of Luke at the Transfiguration. So there's a clear reference all the way here, all the way through here to that monumental, stunning event that is recorded first of all in the Gospel of Mark. And Peter's saying that when I die, I want to leave something behind. I want to make every effort so that when I'm gone, you can at any time recall these things. Now, what could he possibly be referring to? I think it is quite clearly a reference to the creation of the gospel according to Mark. And hopefully by the end of tonight, you'll see that that's a real possibility. So let's have a look at Mark's gospel and why we should read it. So let's start with the why, right? That's great advice, isn't it, from Simon Sinek. Start with why. It's a literary masterpiece. It's the very first gospel that was ever created. So Mark didn't have any precedence. He wasn't writing a novel that came centuries after someone invented the novel. He was creating something entirely new when he sat down to write his account of the life and the works of Jesus of Nazareth. Completely new. And of course that then started a trend that was followed by Matthew, Luke and John and others. Who created Gospels based on Mark's model. So that's pretty stunning, isn't it? It's like the first ever Gospel, and that makes it pretty extraordinary in itself. As we'll see tonight, it's based on the eyewitness narrative of Peter. And as a result, we're always there in the box seat. We're in the boat as it threatens to capsize. We're in the house as Jesus goes back and forward with the Jewish leaders. We're right there on the spot as he wraps his arms around a leper. We get a vivid, up-close, eyewitness account of what happened in the life of Jesus. And Peter's story makes it even more exciting. He's direct, he's vivid, he's fast-paced, he's passionate, and he shows us a Jesus who's very focused on his mission. And we'll look at that as we go through. The picture of Jesus is in itself quite extraordinary. He's human, as we'd expect, but he's also divine. And time again, his disciples, the people around him, are sort of reeling back and thinking, what have we got here? Like, this is a man like no man I've ever met before. You know, this, we've never seen this happen. Who ever heard of this before? And they say that repeatedly throughout the Gospel of Mark as Jesus does things that are simply extraordinary. And through it all, Mark weaves together powerful theological statements. You know, we might tend to use the word doctrinal. So he's teaching us things about who Jesus is. And what life is about and the coming kingdom of God, what does it mean? But he also tells us pastoral things like how we ought to live. How do you cope with suffering and persecution? How do you cope when things go wrong? How do you continue to believe when life is difficult? Mark covers those sorts of things as well to instruct and encourage us as we read his gospel. Now we looked at this passage from Peter, and I think that's the first clue that Peter himself intended to leave something behind him. And I'll give you some reasons to think that that is Mark's gospel in just a moment. But if you think about the timing, we know actually pretty closely when Peter was killed. It's pretty certain historically that he was executed by Nero as part of the great persecution of Christians in Rome that followed the Great Fire of Rome. And Nero, perhaps looking to deflect suspicion from himself, whether it was justified or not, he was a politician, right? And he needed a solution, a scapegoat. And so he picked on the Christians. He said, look at them! And so everybody, you know, looked at the Christians. And there was a bit of sympathy for them, actually, because people had a strong sense that they weren't really the culprits. But Nero was able to make use of them and punish them savagely for what had happened. And Peter died in that persecution. So about 64 AD. But before the destruction of Jerusalem, which Mark still treats as a prophecy in chapter 13, and that came in 70. So there's a very narrow band of time, if you like, in which Mark wrote his gospel. Now, just to illustrate the tradition about this gospel, William Barclay calls this an early, widespread and unanimous tradition in the church. And in another place he says it's the most well-attested of any tradition from the ancient church. And he quotes, there's three quotations I'll just quickly give you. The first of these is from a guy called Papias, who was a bishop of a city in Turkey around the area of Ephesus and Colossae, places like that. And he wrote a book called The Exposition of the Oracles of the Lord. Now, that is not extant, right? You cannot find that book. It didn't survive. But fortunately, this paragraph was quoted by a famous church historian called Eusebius of Caesarea. And in his ecclesiastical history, he quoted this paragraph from Papias, and so it has survived. And this is what it says. The elder said this too. Mark, who was Peter's interpreter, wrote down accurately but artlessly all that he remembered of what Christ had said or done. He did not hear the Lord, nor was he a follower of his, but at a later date, as I have said, he followed Peter, who gave his teaching anecdotally, not as if he were making a systematic compilation of the Lord's oracles. Mark therefore made no mistake, but he wrote things down, some as he remembered them, for he had one purpose in mind, not to omit anything he'd heard and not to falsify anything. So there's this strong view from early in church history. Look at the dates, right? This guy was born 30 years after Jesus was crucified. It's like writing a book about the Hawke Prime Ministership. It's about the same time gap. It's really not ancient history at all. It's fairly recent history. Or maybe if politics isn't your thing, you can think of a musician or a sports star who was active in the 70s and the 80s. And think about it. It's not really that long ago. Maybe it is to some of you, but to me, it's I was alive. So not long at all. A couple more quotes just to back this point up from a little later, but still really within a stone's throw of the beginnings of Christianity, a writer called Justin Martyr, who died for his faith. He changed the name of one of the apostles to Peter, and when it is written in his memoirs, so he calls the Gospel of Mark the memoirs of Peter, right? This is sort of Peter's account of life with Jesus, if you like. That this so happened, as well as that he changed the names of other two brothers, the sons of Zebedee, to Boanerges, which means sons of thunder. That fact only occurs in the Gospel of Mark. And so it's quite unambiguous, really, that Justin Martyr is referring to the Gospel of Mark as the memoirs of Peter. And then in a little later again, Irenaeus of Lyon in France, after their death, Mark, the disciple and interpreter of Peter, also handed down to us in writing the things preached by Peter. So it's quite a strong tradition, and it never varies, right? All through early church history, the Gospel of Mark is attributed originally to Peter. And so it's a very old gospel. It's the first of the Gospels. In fact, parts of it might be older again. I'm not going to go into this in a lot of detail, but you'll notice that the middle quotation, this is from the letter to the Galatians, right? So the Apostle Paul, writing off his fast and furious letter to the Galatians, he says, because you are children of God, God has sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. Now that phrase that Paul is quoting in context, he's talking about the Son calling out to his Father, Abba, Father. That incident only occurs in the wording only occurs in the Gospel of Mark. He quotes it again in Romans chapter 8, but it's originally taken from Mark 14, verse 36. And so it's quite possible that that last few chapters of Mark that have the focused account of Jesus' crucifixion and his resurrection, just those last three chapters, might even be older again. They might have been written down well before the full Gospel was put together, be that as it may. Now, you'll probably notice when you read through the Gospels that the first three Gospels are quite closely connected, right? You can find the parable of the sower, for example, in the Gospel according to Matthew, the Gospel according to Mark, and the Gospel according to Luke. And lots of the stories, lots of the parables similarly. And you sort of think, well, what's the point? Well, it seems that what happened is Mark wrote his Gospel first, and then along came Matthew and Luke and said, look, that's really very good material, but I want to tell a whole lot of other stories about Jesus. I want to record a lot more parables. I want to provide systematic compilations of Jesus' teaching. I want to actually go back to the Old Testament and provide a lot of connections to the Old Testament which show prophecy being fulfilled in the life of Jesus. And so Matthew and Luke sort of augmented what Mark had put down and created their own masterpieces in turn. Now, you're welcome to these slides, by the way, if you want to sort of follow them through in more detail later on. I don't want to bamboozle anybody, but just have a look at the pink circle of Mark, and you can see that 76%, over three quarters of Mark's gospel, can also be found, sometimes word for word, in the gospels of Luke and of Matthew. And 56% of the gospel of Matthew, so over half, comes from Mark. And slightly less, 42% of the gospel according to Luke, so nearly half. And then, of course, they have other sources as well for their material. Luke talks about the fact that he did a lot of research and he was very careful to put together an accurate history of the life of Jesus. And so, although we might sort of come along, we got the finished work, a lot of work went into that. And the authors were very careful to gather facts and stories and teaching of Jesus and put it together into a coherent narrative in the Gospels. And we really should value that tremendous work that they did very early in the Christian movement. So quite remarkable connections between the three, but we're just going to focus on the Gospel of Mark over these studies. Now I want to tell you a little bit about Mark himself, because it's quite a striking story. And I think it's a great one for young people particularly, although there's something for all of us to learn, because Mark was a young man who made a big mistake. And it was difficult to come back from that, but he did. And so his life story, if you like, is a story of failure and redemption. And I think that's something we can all relate to, right? We all, you know, you never know what tomorrow's going to bring, and suddenly you might be confronted with a situation you didn't expect, and you say the wrong thing or you do the wrong thing, and then it's very hard to sort of pull back from that and recover from that. And sometimes the effects of some more serious mistakes can be with us for a long time. And we find that difficult to look people in the eye again, perhaps, or mix with people, or rebuild friendships. That can all be difficult. Now, Mark is a story that encourages us to be positive about those situations and do what we can to rebuild our relationships and our connections. We don't have time, you know, this is a whole sort of exhortation, if you like, in itself, but let's just try and pick up the key facts. So first of all, Mark has got an important connection. He was a cousin of Barnabas, and we're told that in Colossians chapter 4, verse 10. And that probably means that, like Barnabas, he was a Levite. So here's someone who had quite a well-defined, a sort of a privileged role, if you like, within the people of God because of the involvement of the Levites in the temple service. He grew up at the centre of the Jesus movement in Jerusalem. Now, you might like to have a look at some of these quotations. So Acts chapter 12, verse 12, look at how this is put. I think this is the first time it is actually that the scriptures refer to Mark by name. So in Acts 12, verse 12, this is the time when Peter was in prison and miraculously he was set free. He stands out in the street, where do I go? And he says, right, I know where to go. Verse 12, Acts 12, verse 12. When he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. Right, so he thought, where do I go? Yeah, okay, that's the obvious place. And off he goes to a house that was clearly at the headquarters or the centre, if you like, of the Christian movement in Jerusalem. And it's owned by Mary, so presumably Mark's father is dead at this point, but he's mentioned, John, whose other name was Mark. And he keeps being called John, whose other name was Mark, until a certain point in the story. After that, he's just Mark, and there's a reason for that. So you can perhaps understand psychologically that with his father dead and he's still young, perhaps he's looking around for an older man to attach himself to, a mentor, a father figure, if you like. And certainly Mark does seem to have done that, because three significant older men in his life provided him with that kind of role model, if you like, that he was able to relate to. And I'm sure a similar thing happens for women as well. And first of all, it was Barnabas. So if you just look further down in this chapter to verse 25, Barnabas and Saul had been in Jerusalem at around this time to deliver charity funding for the ecclesia in Jerusalem. It was going to face a massive famine. People would die of starvation. And so the church at Antioch said, okay, well, one thing we can do about this is put together some cash. We'll collect money and then we'll take that to Jerusalem and they can use that to buy food. That's something we can do for our brothers and sisters in Jerusalem. And so Barnabas and Saul took the money to Jerusalem with them. And when they returned back to Antioch, verse 25, they took with them John, whose other name was Mark. And so off he goes, he leaves Jerusalem. It's a big adventure. But I'm sure he was a serious young man, and he thought, right, this is my opportunity to enter into the service of Christ. And off he goes with Barnabas and Mark back to the big congregation in Antioch. And then when Barnabas and Saul get called by God, by Jesus, the Spirit, to go out on the first missionary journey, Mark goes with them. So I don't know if any of you remember back to the first time you did some mission work. I'm sure there's some people in the room who've done that. You can remember the first time it's both a big adventure and it's also a bit scary. It's rewarding, but it's also completely new, isn't it? You're not sure how to behave or what to say to what people. You don't know the language. The food is different even, and you're often sleeping in uncomfortable places, and you're travelling dangerously. So it's a bit of an adventure, but it's also a challenging time. Anyway, Mark was up for it, so off he went with Barnabas and Saul. Now we're told about him in just have a look a little bit further down, 13 verse 4. So being sent out by the Holy Spirit, they went down to Seleucia, the port of Antioch, and from there they sailed to the island of Cyprus. When they arrived at Salamis, they proclaimed the word of God in the synagogues of the Jews, and they had John to assist them, or the King James Version has, they had John to their minister. Now the Greek word there is the same word that's used of the synagogue attendant or deacon in Luke chapter 4, the one who handed the scroll to Jesus when he had that famously short reading and the exhortation that was so challenging they threw him off a cliff. And that's never happened to me here, but it did happen to Jesus in Nazareth. And that person was called the Kazan in Hebrew, or the synagogue attendant or deacon. And it appears that Mark had been trained and had the role of being that same kind of person, and so he assisted them in proclaiming the word of God in the synagogues of the Jews. But something happened to change his view of this whole mission, right? Have a look down at verse 13. There's a bit of an incident in between what we don't really have time to look into today or tonight, but in verse 13, now Paul and his companions set sail from Paphos on the island of Cyprus and came to Perga in Pamphylia, and John left them and returned to Jerusalem. And the word there, you can check it out yourself, for leaving means quite a significant departure, no looking back. It's the same word that Jesus uses in Matthew chapter 7 when he says, "Depart from me, ye workers of iniquity." It's not a common word, and it always has this strong sense of go and don't look back. And so what I think happened here was there were angry words and there were fists on the table. And Mark walked out and he slammed the door behind him. And he didn't go back to Antioch where they left from. He went back to Jerusalem. He was really walking out on that mission. And the reason for it would seem to be Paul's determination to take this mission off in a new direction. Well, he was sick of talking to Jews. He's saying, nope, from now on we're going to the Gentiles. That's really what my life mission is about, and we're going to do it. We're going to do it now. And Mark, no way I'm comfortable with that. Back to Jerusalem he goes. And he tells them, because this is how they knew, what Paul was doing. And so, whether he meant to or not, he stirred up a hornet's nest in Jerusalem. And when Paul got back to Antioch, of course, the whole circumcision controversy broke out. And as a result of that, Paul did not trust him, right? He'd taken him on this mission, but he did not trust him. Have a look over Acts 15. Right, the very end of Acts 15, Paul says, oh, it's about time for a second missionary journey, Barnabas. What do you think? Barnabas, great idea. It is time. Let's go back to the people we spoke to before and see how they're going, give them a bit of encouragement, further teaching. Great idea, Paul. And by the way, I'd like to take Mark. What? Right, Paul's not up for that. He says, no, Mark is not coming, right, over my dead body. And a big argument breaks out between Paul and Barnabas, and they never, although they respected each other, they never worked together again. And the reason would seem to be that Paul felt betrayed by what Mark had done, and he didn't trust him, and he wouldn't take him again. And so in verse 39, verse 37, now Barnabas wanted to take with them John called Mark, but Paul thought best not to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. And there arose a sharp disagreement so that they separated from each other. Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas, a completely different person, and departed, having been commended by the brothers to the grace of the Lord. Right? So it's really, Mark realizes now that he made a mistake. He realizes he picked the wrong side in this argument. He'd been wrong to walk out on the mission in Cyprus as they were heading for Asia. Paul had been on the right side there. He realizes all of that now, but he wants a second chance, and Paul's saying, no, there are no second chances, right? I don't take second chance. I don't take walkouts on mission work. I refuse to take Mark. And you can imagine that that would have been very, you know, having sort of worked his way around to the right position and the sort of the truth of this whole controversy about the Gentiles and the work of grace among them, to then be told, no, sorry, you are not acceptable by someone like Paul, who now he admired and trusted, would be really tough to take. So he just goes with Barnabas to do what he can. From this moment on, he's only called Mark, his Greek name, and that imitates Saul's own change of name earlier in chapter 13. Well, what did he do? He found things to do, right? He didn't give up. He worked. Have a look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 13. So I thought, well, you know, there's only one way through this problem, and that is to keep going, to prove myself. And if Paul won't have me, well, I'll just do what I can, and then maybe in time I'll regain his trust, and you know, we can talk about what happened there in Cyprus, that big argument that we had. Well, he's just got to hope, doesn't he, really? Have a look in 1 Peter 5, verse 13. She who was at Babylon, or Babylonia, the province of Babylon, there's a big Jewish community there, that's where Peter was working at the time, who was likewise chosen, sends you greetings, and so does Mark, my son. So Peter's really taken him under his wing, hasn't he? He said, Mark, you come with me, right? You know, there's lots to do. If you can't work with Paul, you know, there's plenty to do over here. Let's go east. And they headed off to Mesopotamia and did a whole lot of work among the Jewish community over there. And Mark was an important part of that. Well, as it turns out, this story does have a happy ending. If you come over to Philemon, not always the easiest book to find, blink and you'll miss it, but it's just before Hebrews. And if you find that, you'll see that when Paul sends greetings from the people with him in Rome, in prison, or at least moving in and out of his house arrest arrangements in Rome, Mark is among them, right? Philemon, verse 24. Epaphras, my fellow prisoner in Christ Jesus, sends greetings to you. Now, Epaphras wasn't in jail, right? So Paul calls him his fellow prisoner because Epaphras was in Rome, you know, sharing Paul's food, sitting at his table, helping him, writing letters for him maybe, or carrying letters to and fro, and he's sharing Paul's imprisonment voluntarily. And so Paul calls him out here in verse 23 of Philemon and commends him implicitly for being willing to take that role. And as he ends his letter to Philemon, he says, by the way, Epaphras says hello. And so does Mark. So there he is in Rome now, serving Paul, you know, regaining his trust and regaining his confidence. He's mentioned in Colossians 4 verse 10, which is written at the same time. And then just have a look back two books to 2 Timothy 4, and just look at what he says here about Mark. This is at the very end of Paul's life. And you can see how the he's come full circle now, and he really is back in Paul's good graces. And this is what Paul says about him in 2 Timothy chapter 4. He says to Timothy in verse 9, do your best to come to me soon. For Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. That would be hard for Paul to take, wouldn't it? He's on trial for his life. In fact, he's been convicted. He knows the day of death hasn't been set, but it must be soon. And people are starting to leave. And Demas, well, he thinks he's gone for no good reason at all. He's just getting away. Crescens has gone to Galatia, Titus to Dalmatia. Maybe they were on mission trips. Luke alone is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you, for he is very useful to me for ministry. Now, you know, Paul, like, that's a really positive statement, isn't it? Right? He doesn't just say, Mark's been pretty handy. He says, he's very useful to me for ministry. So, by this stage, of course, Paul has now completely reversed his view of Mark. He's very positive about him. And at the end, as Barclay says, there's no one he wanted to be with him more than Mark. Mark really meant a lot to him at that point, and he trusted him to do whatever he needed to do. And so perhaps this is how Mark came to be in Rome when Peter was killed, and he wrote the gospel about that time. So that's Mark's story, a story of failure and redemption. And I think as we read the gospel, let's remember it's written by someone who at one stage Paul thought was a loser. But he was able to come back because he was committed to rebuilding his relationship and his life. And he won Paul's confidence again. Now, who did Mark write to? Right? If we were maybe if we were sitting in some catacomb in Rome, and we would receive this gospel for the very first time and read it, that would be a supremely exciting thing, wouldn't it? Because there's never been anything like this before. It's a new kind of thing, a gospel. And it's going to be written for us, and we're going to hear it read for the first time. It would be very exciting. And hopefully as we come to it, we can come to it as much as we can with that sort of fresh mindset and rediscover its riches. So it's pretty clear, in fact, from the gospel itself, and you need to go behind it to the Greek, and I'm reliant on expert opinion for this, of course. But there's plenty of evidence in the text of Mark that it was written for the Christians of Rome. All the way through Mark's gospel, he finds himself explaining things. You know, he says, oh, the Jew, oh, by the way, and he'll spend a few verses explaining the Jewish rules for washing pots and couches and things like that. Why do you need an explanation like that? Well, because you're not Jewish. Right? You don't really get it. Why are they so fanatical about cleansing everything? And so he explains it for his readers. And quite frequently he spells out the meaning of Jewish names or Jewish customs for his writers. And often he does that using Latin terms. So that's why it's quite clear it's written for Latin. No other book of the New Testament does that. So if Mark wants to explain what two lepta are, and that they're actually two little brass coins, like a 2-cent piece, if you can remember them, from the 70s and 80s, of course. He explains it using a Roman coin, a quadrans, which they would understand, right? It's like converting, like $2, well, $2 is about a pound, he might say, if he's writing for English readers. So he's explaining it in their terms. He often uses Latin words instead of Greek words. So the first one, legion, of course, is the name for that crazy madman that Jesus confronted on the shores of the Lake of Galilee. And he uses the Roman word, legion, for his name instead of the equivalent Greek word. And he does that for a number of things, including a centurion. Centurion, there's a perfectly good Greek word for a centurion. It's got about 13 syllables. But Mark uses the Latin word centurion. And it's telling that it's a centurion, last of all, who testifies that Jesus is dead, but that he died an extraordinary death. Now, we might just like to have a look at that. Just have a look at Mark 15. Mark deliberately chooses this sort of final witness to Jesus being the Son of God, if you like, because he's writing to Romans, and they'd be so fascinated by that. What? There was a Roman centurion was right there, and he saw him die, and this is what he said about it. And they'd be really excited about that because they could relate to that. They might have had relatives who were in the Roman army. And so it would be exciting for them that it wasn't just all a Jewish story, but there was this Roman who played a role in it as well. So have a look at Mark 15, verse 39, or verse 37, right? Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. Well, it's quite a dramatic expiration, if you like, a dramatic death. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him, right? So even that little detail tells you, doesn't it? The centurion was watching intently what was going on the cross, right? He wasn't just, you know, doing whatever, playing noughts and crosses in the sand on the, you know, because he was bored. He was standing there watching this man enthralled by Jesus, and he's seen crucifixions before, right? I mean, there's two other people dying either side of him. He's not watching them. He's watching this man because he's never seen anything like it. When the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. Now, what gave the centurion that insight? I don't know. You know, maybe it's just the inspiration of the moment. But that's what he said. And that was heard by other people who Mark knew, Christians who were there close to the cross at the time. And so Mark knew that fact and he wrote it into his gospel. Now, this centurion plays a bit more of a role. Have a look down at verse 42. When evening had come, since it was the day of preparation, that is the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a respected member of the council, who was also himself looking for the kingdom of God, took courage and went to Pilate, the Roman governor, and asked for the body of Jesus. Pilate was surprised to hear that he should have already died. And summoning the centurion, right? So he sends a messenger off, and the messenger goes through the streets and out the gate, off to where the crucifixion is, and he taps the centurion on the shoulder and says, "The governor wants to talk to you." And the centurion makes his way back into the palace. "Sir, you know, is this man really dead?" And the centurion confirms it. He asked him whether he was already dead. And when he looked at the centurion that he was dead, he granted the corpse to Jesus. Right, the centurion played this key role. And that is very important for the story, because what it means is, unlike the poor beggars either side of Jesus, who were sort of, you know, they had their legs smashed and then they were taken down and thrown into a pauper's grave and buried and no headstone, you know, they were just gone, right, or burned because they were criminals. No one cared about their body. But Jesus had this special treatment at the hands of Joseph because he had died early, and the centurion testified to that. And so that sort of set the scene for the resurrection that followed. So, you know, we've got to put ourselves, if you like, in the shoes of the first readers. We're there in Rome, right? We're in a time of persecution. We come from all the common folk of Rome a lot of the time, right? Might be a butcher, might be a slave. And Rome is a massive city, millions of people, one of the biggest city of the ancient world at the time. It was a terrible city. Roman writers said it's a giant sewer into which all the filth of the world flows. That's what they said about Rome, right? So it's a challenging place to live, and you've become a Christian. And now, if you confess that faith out in the streets and the markets of Rome, chances are someone will inform on you and you will die a horrific death. You might be doused in petrol and put up on a pole and lit to illuminate Nero's pleasure gardens. Or you might be sewn into a wild animal skin and chased by dogs. That's the sorts of things that Nero did because he had his terrible, twisted sense of humour that we know from history. But you're gathered now underground in a safe place, you hope, and you're going to hear this gospel read, and you're going to read about this man Jesus and the centurion's testimony to his death. Now, there's a lot of reasons why Mark wrote, and we're going to explore them as we make our way through the gospel. But I want to talk now about the fact that Mark got this account from Peter. So even though, Papias said in that very first quotation, Mark wasn't actually there. He wasn't a disciple of Jesus himself, but he clung to Peter and he got Peter's account, and that's what you're hearing in the Gospel of Mark. Everything that Peter said, all the stories he told vividly and the parables he recounted and the miracles that he explained, Mark, you know, soaked that all up, and then he wrote it into his gospel, if you like. And so what we've got in Mark's gospel is Peter's experience of Jesus. Now, you want to look for this as we read through it, because it puts a whole new light on the story, right? It's, if you think about the story, it begins, well, almost at the very beginning, Peter is there. As Jesus calls out, he's walking along the beach on his way to the synagogue. He says, "Peter and Andrew," right, later on it was James and John, "come follow me. I'll make you fishers of men." And so they just drop their nets and off they go into the synagogue with Jesus. And from that time on, they are drawn more and more into his circle and his life. And that's right at the very beginning, the first few verses of the Gospel of Mark. And then, of course, if you're probably in chapter 15. Well, just to have a look in chapter 16, verse 7. Right? The angel at the tomb says to the women who've come to the tomb, he says, verse 7, "Tell his disciples and Peter that he's going before you into Galilee." He's got a special message for Peter. Of course, that's because Peter, not long before, had denied Jesus, and he needs to know that he's still included in the group. In fact, he's got an important role to play. And so the whole gospel, if you like, is about Jesus, but the key subplot is about Peter and his experience of Jesus, and he's at the center of the story. So it's Peter's boat that is there all the way through the story. It's Peter's house that's there all the way through the story. Jesus sat at his table, cuddled his kids, we're told, right? Argued with the Pharisees in his living room. And Peter was there the whole time and saw all of this, participated in it, was right there in the front row as this drama unfolded, if you like. And his whole life, spiritual life, his call to discipleship, his call to leadership, his declaration that Jesus was the Christ, his attempt to prevent Jesus from going up to Jerusalem, "This will not be unto you, Lord. Get behind me, Satan." His witness to the transfiguration, his collapse in the high priest's palace, his it's all there in this gospel. And so it's the story of Jesus and Peter in a lot of ways, all the way through. But he's never held up on a pedestal. He's never sort of painted as a special person or anything like that. He's often criticized, but it's certainly the story about Peter and the way he experienced Jesus. So all the way through, you'll see when we get to the stories, and you've probably noticed this already, you know, working through it with James. I'm sure he brought many of these details out. But there's lots of sort of eyewitness details that are unique to Mark's gospel. And so he talks about little things that he saw and heard. And often these details are uniquely recorded in the Gospel of Mark. So in that dramatic story of the boat on the lake and the storm just comes out of nowhere and the waves are coming in and the disciples who've, you know, lived all their life on that lake, almost every night they're out fishing. So they've seen plenty of storms before. This time they really think they're going to die. And in the end, out of desperation, they grab Jesus and they say, "Master," or "Teacher, don't you care that we perish?" That's what they really thought was going to happen. And Jesus just stands up and he says, "Peace, be still." And this raging tumult becomes a millpond, just like that. What manner of man is this? That even the wind and the sea obey him. They couldn't believe it. Well, Mark records, for example, that he was asleep on the cushion. Just that little detail which Peter saw and remembered as he told the story. And there's lots of other examples of just the look in Jesus' eyes or the gesture of Jesus or the way in which the people affected by demons, as they thought, behaved. All of that really captured Peter's imagination, and it comes through in the gospel. So it really is a very vivid and a colourful gospel as we read it. And it's not only what Peter saw, but also what he heard. And so he often records the actual words of Jesus. So imagine that. You know, you could probably, memories are crazy things, aren't they, right? You have a particular smell, or suddenly you walk into a room and you think of something like summer, or you think of a person, or you think of an event that happened in your past. There's all these triggers that set off the neurons, and you know, we remember these extraordinary memories that were captured in our past, like photographs. And that's what it was like for Peter as well. And he remembered specific things that Jesus said. And he could hear his voice speaking these words, and then he gives the Greek equivalent, just so that his readers understand. But he records the actual words. So when Jesus called James and John the sons of thunder, or Boanerges as it is in Greek, Peter remembers him saying that, giving them that nickname. Or when Peter was just one of three, Peter, James and John, went into the house of Jairus, whose daughter had died, 12-year-old daughter had died, and she's just lying there cold and still and white. And Jesus just reaches out to her and takes her by the hand and says, "Talitha kumi," just in that really gentle tone, speaking to a little girl, and her eyes come open and the colour comes back to her cheeks and she sits up in the bed. And Jesus' first thought is for her, give her some food. You know, his first thought is for her. Peter was there and he heard him say that. And it's still living in his imagination, these things that Jesus said. Healing a blind man or a mute man, or on his place on the ground in the Garden of Gethsemane, or on the cross in dying agony, calling out to God. Peter was there and he heard all these things, and he repeats them in his gospel. Now, there's just one last thing that I'd like to look at before we wrap up tonight, and that is this view of Jesus as the Son of God. Just come back to Mark 1, verse 1. This is the thing to look out for as we go through the gospel. And it's sort of threaded through the gospel, if you like, but it's just the term itself is used quite a number of times, but there's so many ways in which Mark illustrates what that means by these acts of extraordinary authority or power that Jesus is responsible for. So in the very first verse of Mark's gospel, he gives us like the headline, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And so he tells us, doesn't he, what his agenda is from verse 1, 1 verse 1. It's going to be about that. Now, that is, he comes back to that theme again and again through the course of the gospel. The next time is verse 11 of this same chapter, where it's God himself who says, "You are my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." And everyone listens to that and hears that. But now it's God endorsing him. And then repeatedly, people who are mentally ill, they just don't have the inhibitions of others, they're calling it out. And Jesus has to say, shh, that's not for now. I'm not making a big thing of that right at the moment. But they could see it and they feel that power and talk about it in that sort of uninhibited way that people have if they are mentally ill often. There's another divine affirmation on the Transfiguration, the Mount of Transfiguration, where God again speaks and identifies his Son. And then Jesus himself claims it, and as we've seen at the end of his life, a Roman centurion acknowledges it as well. So from the very beginning to the very end of the gospel, again and again and again, that truth is pointed out and underlined. Now, what that means is that Jesus himself had an extraordinary mission, and he was a very focused man. Now, if you've heard studies about the Gospel of Mark before, you probably remember, because it's often made a point of, that there's this word euthus that means immediately or right away or then, right? Straight away. Right? As soon as the class was finished, Mike went out and got a glass of water. That kind of idea is there 42 times in the Gospel, and that is 71% of the total occurrences in the New Testament. So it's a big, big theme of Mark's gospel, which is the shortest of all the gospels. Now, why is that? Why does he portray a Jesus who goes almost like point to point? He's here doing this, and then as soon as he's going there and he's doing that, and then as soon as that's done, he's going there and he's doing that, and he just keeps moving through life over 3.5 years of his mission in this incredibly focused way, point to point to point. Why is Jesus like that? Why does Mark tell that story in that way? Well, it's because Jesus was such an incredibly focused person because he had a job to do. Now have a look at Mark 10 verse 38. There was a time, and this is really only about a week before his crucifixion, right? Jesus and his disciples are on the way up to Jerusalem, and maybe within 10 days or something like that, he's going to be crucified. And two of his disciples, James and John, think, okay, the kingdom must be getting really close, so we better claim our seat. And they go with their mother to speak to Jesus. They say, by the way, when it happens, we would like to sit left and right of you. And really, it was a big overstep, right? Because essentially they're saying, you know, we really think that of the 12, the two of us, your cousins, really deserve this place of honour. Big overstep. Jesus doesn't tear strips off them like he could have, but he sort of talks them through that. Now look at what he says in verse 38. Jesus said to them, "You don't know what you're asking. You have no idea. Like, if you really want that, you have no idea what is involved." Like, he knows where he's going and what that's going to take out of him. "Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with a baptism with which I am baptized?" Now, his baptism, of course, was the event that started it all, wasn't it? That's where his mission began, 3.5 years before. He stepped out of the crowd, he stepped down into the water, he was baptized by John, and from that moment he was irrevocably committed to that course of action. Like, Jesus could see the cross 3.5 years out, and he's heading right there. And when he takes that step and gets baptized, he knows where that's going. And he's committing himself to that at the moment he gets baptized. And of course, the cup if you like, is a forward reference to the Garden of Gethsemane, where the moment of commitment, isn't it? Take away this cup from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what thou wilt. And so there Jesus reaffirms his commitment to doing the will of God, whatever it takes. So from his baptism to the acceptance of that cup, if you like, the symbolic drinking of a symbolic cup that means I'm going to die. Right? And if that's what you need from me, God, that's what I'm giving. I'm not holding anything back here. Jesus is saying, that's my mission. Are you up for that? They had no idea, did they? Right? And often, perhaps thankfully, when we set out on that course of discipleship, we ask to get baptized. We perhaps don't realize at that point in time what the next 40 or 50 or 60 years of discipleship could bring, because maybe we'd be a bit daunted to think that we would take all of that on at that moment. But we do. We make our commitment, and then God supports us as we make our way through life to do his will. Well, Jesus knew what was coming, and he was committed to that from the very beginning. And that's why Mark paints this picture of Jesus, a man on a mission, in this way. Now, we're not going to spend any much more time on this because we've reached almost the limits of our time. And if I sit down a minute early, I'll get chocolate or something. I don't know, but that's what we're going to do, right? But just to finish with this point, as we work our way through the Gospel of Mark, if you read it yourself or through these studies, you'll see time and time again how Jesus is human, has human emotions. He sees someone who's got this disease riddling his body and is completely isolated from human contact and community. And he doesn't feel repelled by that or, you know, weirded out. He embraces the man because he feels this huge surge of compassion and pity for him. But he can also be angry. He can be stern. He can be tired. He can be surprised. He can confess that he doesn't know everything. He's got gaps in his knowledge. He can feel love. So all of the things that we do as humans in our confusion sometimes, Jesus experienced those emotions too. And so he's very much a human being in many respects, entirely like us. But of course, in other ways, uniquely unlike us. And we can never forget that. And so there's other times, of course, all the way through the Gospel, I've just picked out the ones that jumped out at me, where in the stories that are told, or in the miracles, or the way Jesus speaks, or the prophecies, and we'll look at some of these next week, the prophecies that are reinterpreted, if you like, about Jesus, this man who is mind-blowingly divine is also presented to us as well. And so he's both at the same time. He's like us. And he's unlike us. He's something extraordinarily different. And yet, on the other hand, he can stand alongside us and be one with us as well. So an extraordinary person. And Mark's Gospel is the story of that extraordinary person as told by someone who had a front row seat and wants to pass on to us for our benefit, our encouragement, and our guidance, everything that he saw and heard as he prepared himself to die.